And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for the month of August 2022. Currently, the global carbon dioxide levels are 419.08 parts per million, and there are 2,729 days left until the year 2030, a year of reckoning. Clock keeps ticking. So I don't know if you noticed it in the news lately, but the Supreme Court has been popping up a lot. It has done, as you know, the Supreme Court term begins in October. They hear cases. They all have lunch together and make peanut butter saltines and decide cases. And then come June, all of the cases are released. So you probably heard there were six or seven enormous Supreme Court decisions that dropped at the end of June 2022. Today, we're focused on one in particular of those, which is the decision called West Virginia versus EPA. And dear listener, we are not going to be able to unpack the entire thing for you because there's so many implications and ramifications and sidebar discussions to be had. But I think it's worth plugging through some of the issues. To that end, because it's the Supreme Court, we like to have actual legal experts on board. We have as a guest an attorney, Ms. Frances McIntyre, who has a lot of legal experience and is willing to tell us what's going on with the EPA with this case. Fran, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Ted. Glad to be here.
So full disclosure, Fran is my sister, and we've sort of talked through some of these issues in the past, but there you go. Anyway, so
Still happy to be here.
Despite the fact that we're related, yeah. So the SCOTUS decision in West Virginia versus EPA is enormous. And in order to just get a context, we will go screaming through 60 or 70 years of history. Right? So from my perspective, the background for what has happened in this West Virginia versus EPA case rewinds all the way back to the New Deal in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt created a lot of federal agencies, right? There's a whole alphabet soup of agencies. But for example, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, was founded during the 1930s. There are a whole bunch of others. Today, there are agencies. There is the EPA as an agency. There's the CDC. There's the Food and Drug Administration. There's many, many federal agencies. Okay. And so the context for this is that Congress from the 30s up till now has said that Congress, in its wisdom, it has the legislative power. It sets a goal and then tells the executive branch to execute on this goal and to make regulations to fill in all the details that Congress can't decide, because you're never going to have a vote in Congress about what the SEC, whether or not they should, do specific things in immediate interest, in immediate moments, right? So traditionally, Congress has delegated to the federal agencies a lot of power to interpret the laws that Congress has passed and to set out regulations. In 1984, that question came to a head before the Supreme Court. And in a decision that involved the Chevron Oil Company, the Supreme Court decided something called the doctrine became known as the Chevron deference. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that the agencies of the federal government understand the issues far better than the court or the Congress does, and that the Supreme Court should give deference to a federal government agency's interpretation of the law that Congress gave it, because the agency knows better than the Supreme Court. That Chevron deference is in keeping with the long-term operation of the federal government, right? That's just how we run things nowadays. And the Supreme Court said in 1984, that was a good thing. The agencies know what's going on. When they make a rule, we have to respect their greater knowledge. Okay. They still with me, Fran? I'm still talking away.
I'll just offer a couple of observations. First thing is, this is an area of administrative or agency law, and none of us can get through a day without encountering many, many agencies. You can't drive wherever you want. You can't drive as fast as you want. You can't take your plane up whenever you want. You can't practice dentistry wherever and whenever you want. Every single act that we undertake, almost every single act, is regulated by some agency. And it might be helpful just to think about in terms of separation of powers, Ted. You know, Congress makes the laws and then they delegate it to the executive, and the executive executes the law. And the president can't execute all the laws, so he has various secretariats and various agencies that come in under those secretariats that actually create regulations and regulatory schemes that control our day-to-day lives. There's a parallel on the state side, of course, where the state legislatures will enact laws and grant authority to execute them to the governor, who then executes them through the various state agencies. And so you run into your Department of Motor Vehicles and your Board of Registration of Nursing and the FAA and all of these in the course of your everyday life. So you're absolutely right. The question in the Chevron case was whether or not the courts ought to defer to the agencies and respect their point of view with regard to what the Congress meant when they delegated certain responsibilities to the executive, that the administrative agencies have the expertise to analyze and understand and interpret better than courts, not just the Supreme Court, but all federal courts and state courts as well, give substantial deference to the agency. The agency knows about the regulation of dentists, not the Superior Court judge. So the agency is the one that is granted the authority to regulate who can practice and who can lose their license. So it's an area of law that is substantial, and the Chevron doctrine is an important one, but it basically comes down to separation of powers.
So thank you for that. And I guess the next sort of big chunk of things you need to think about is that the ability of the federal government to set regulations, with the Environmental Protection Agency to set environmental regulations, really, really, really rankles a lot of fossil fuel people, right? They don't like the fact that the EPA can tell them what to do. There's this guy, there's these brothers named Koch, who you may have heard of, who have more money than God, and they, for the last few years, have been messing around with legal theories that would change the Chevron deference. And we'll get back to that in a minute. But the idea that the federal government can make these regulations really angers and upsets people in the fossil fuel industry, among other places, and they would like to find a way to reverse that. I'm sure you know as well that the makeup of the Supreme Court has recently changed and tilted dramatically in a conservative direction. We just leave that there because it is mind-numbing for most people to see what's happened to the Supreme Court, but that's just a fact. Okay, so those are the two sort of antecedents, if I could use a legal word, Fran. I'm not sure that's a sensible word. But I mean, you have those two ideas in the back of your head, and you get to climate change. Okay, so again, a rapid historical summary says the following thing, that the Obama administration knew it wanted to address climate change and wanted to find a plan to do it. In the Clean Air Act, there is a famous clause called paragraph 111D. You'll see it come up over and over again, 111D. The Obama administration, in this particular clause, 111D, says essentially that the EPA, when it regulates a pollutant like carbon dioxide, when it regulates a pollutant, it has to use what's in quotation marks called the best system of emission reduction. The best system of emission reduction. Oh, hang on to that, because that comes back around again. The Obama administration decided that in terms of carbon dioxide pollution, the best system of emission reductions did not necessarily involve burning, changing the factory or the power plant. They said, oh yeah, you know, you don't have to tear that power plant down. You just need to make more solar panels and stuff, not necessarily on the property of the of the power plant company, right? So this was kind of an aggressive interpretation of this 111D, because the Obama administration said the system involved all of the things that produce electricity, not just the coal plant. Okay. And so the Obama administration put up something called the CPP, the Clean Power Plan, way back in 2015 in the before times. And ironically, just before he died, Antonin Scalia of the Supreme Court stopped the Clean Power Plan. He put it on hold. There was a petition with some funny Latin name that came to the Supreme Court saying, please, we're all going to have terrible things happen if the Clean Power Plan is implemented. Please tell the Obama administration to stop it. And Scalia did. He forced the Obama administration to stop implementing the Clean Power Plan. And then, I mean, I keep joking, but ironically, like a lightning bolt struck, and he died within a few days, right? So, okay, so the Obama Clean Power Plan that uses Clause 111D and determines the best system of emission reduction as something called shifting the generation to places away from the coal plants, that's dead in the water. Then President number 45 comes in, the former guy arrives on the scene, and he releases a new plan called, I think it's called the Affordable Power Plan.
Affordable Clean Energy, ACE.
Affordable Clean Energy, which is basically a nothing, wasn't going to really do much for anything, okay? And back and forth cases about that. But then finally, Mr. Biden becomes president, and he withdraws the Trump plan, the Affordable Clean Power Plan. So now there is no global warming plan that EPA has. And Biden says, oh, yeah, we're going to give you a plan in 18 months. Trust me, it's going to be great. And so there was no plan. And it was at that point that West Virginia, using money funded, basically, I'll just say it without, I don't have a reference, but using Koch funded money, these guys all got together and ran to the Supreme Court and said, please take up this case where we think the Obama plan is against the law. And Fran, this is where I'm going to look at you, because it seems to me that from what I've learned, there's this whole issue of if you want to have a lawsuit, you have to have what's called standing in quotation marks. That means you have to be harmed. There has to be something going on. And in this particular case, there was nothing going on because there was no plan. There was no Obama plan. There was no Trump plan. There was no Biden plan. But nevertheless, the court took it on, proactively took on a decision here and said, we will consider this case. Is that fair? Do you think that was a good thing?
Well, I don't think it was because of the intellectual poverty, frankly, of the decision. But you're probably wondering how they took it on. What was the procedural method by which they took it on? And the reason that Roberts said that the issue was not moot, even though there was no statute on the book, the Clean Power Plan issue was not moot because the EPA might do such a thing again. And the fact that they might decide to wrongfully engage in enforcing a sector-wide climate change plan was sufficient risk for them to say, we will take it up. The issue is not moot. And so that's the reason that's stated in the majority opinion by Roberts. But Kagan, who writes a crushing dissent, says the only reason they took it was, and I quote, this court could not wait to constrain EPA's efforts to address climate change. There was no real reason for them to take it on, but because of their bitterness and their attitude towards climate change regulation. And so the procedural hook is this might happen again, so we have to decide this case now. But they're really,
it was a stretch, though, right? If there's no, the normal thing would be for the Biden plan or the EPA to reintroduce something that looked like the Obama plan, and then the Supreme Court could say that's wrong.
That's right.
But since they hadn't done that, there was no crime committed. There was no bad thing that had happened.
there was an opinion last week in the Washington Post by a professor at Harvard Law School named Vermeule. I'm not saying it right exactly, but it was really brilliant. And he said that they didn't need a dispute. From now on, they're just going to start postulating their judgments on the world and not even wait for a lawsuit. You know, there was just no basis for this piece of litigation.
Okay. So now we've got that out of my system. Let's go on to the actual court case. So West Virginia goes to the Supreme Court and said that the Obama administration in this lawsuit made a mistake. They violated the Constitution by interpreting this famous 111D paragraph that calls for the best system of emission reduction, that they violated the weren't following the will of Congress by implementing this interpretation of the best system of emission reduction. And again, I'll say that the law says that the EPA must find the best system of emission reduction as a sort of title for what they're looking for. The EPA comes back and says the best system would involve the entire electric generation grid, solar panels, power plants, batteries, all kinds of stuff. That's the best way to do it. And the oil companies through the West Virginia said, no, you cannot do that because all of your regulations have to be internal to the plant. And what happened was, is that the Supreme Court, so stay with me here, the Supreme Court summons out of the air, cuts out of whole cloth, a new legal doctrine called the Major Questions Doctrine, which says, which according to the sort of ambiguous definition they give in the statement, is that if an agency like the EPA makes a major, rules on a major question that could transform the economy, like forcing everyone to drive an electric vehicle and have a wind turbine in their backyard, right? This best system of emission reduction. If that were the case, then that would be too major. It's not what Congress wanted them to do. Congress never said that, and that the EPA was overreaching its goal. So did I get that? So, Fran, talk to me about the major question doctrine, where it came from, what it means, what does it make any sense? Is it arbitrary? Talk me off the windowsill.
So basically, 111D says that the EPA shall regulate greenhouse gases at any existing source. That's the terminology, at any existing source. And so the agency then determined that the best system of emission regulation, which I think they refer to as the BSER, B-S-E-R, the BSER, the best system for emissions reduction were two, or maybe they're both the same thing, but one was generation shifting. In other words, to shift away from fossil fuel burning energy sources towards clean energy sources. But that could be done sector-wide, not just within an individual plant. And so they permitted individual plants to trade carbon emission certificates. They permitted individual carbon plants to support wind farms in some other area and basically buy back credits, and permitted these stationary sources by requiring them to shift generation or support generation to in clean sources. The effect of it was that it was going to shut down the coal plants. It was shifting resources away from coal plants, and it was putting resources into clean sources of new electric power. That is the crux of it, really, Ted, is that it was affecting coal interests in West Virginia and the Koch brothers probably, and everything else. But the legal issue here is whether or not EPA was allowed to regulate only within the fence of any source, or they could go outside the fence and regulate across the industry. Mm-hmm. EPA had taken the position in the Clean Power Plan under Obama that they could regulate across the industry because it wasn't contradicted by the statute. They were, after all, the EPA, and they should have Chevron deference. This is what Congress meant. And also, it was the best system of emission reduction. And I guess it truly was. It cost less. It resulted in clean sources of energy being produced, and it was marvelously effective. But the coal-generating plants were slowly deteriorating and losing business. And so essentially the decision here was that the effect of the Clean Power Plan and the generation shifting aspects of it was to really restructure the entire energy industry and to put one part of the industry out of business, that being the coal plants. And that, the Supreme Court thought was, or six of them thought, was a bridge too far. And so in order to pull that back from the brink somehow, because of course Chevron deference said we should be deferring and respecting what EPA says, suddenly the Supreme Court came up with a doctrine. And when they call it a doctrine, it usually, it's supposed to signal something that's been around for a long time, but it was no doctrine. They came up with what's called the Major Questions Doctrine. And that this was, the EPA had violated the Major Questions Doctrine. And what the Major Question Doctrine was, that when there was a major question or a novel question that was being raised as to whether or not a Congress had intended to grant an extraordinary level of power to an agency, that Congress must state that explicitly. We shouldn't have to be left reading the tea leaves of what does any source mean, that Congress should say explicitly, and the EPA can regulate across industry wide. That's the Major Question Doctrine. And so the Supreme Court, Roberts' writing, said that in certain extraordinary cases, and I quote, that's the way they put it, certain extraordinary cases, there must be skepticism against a broad delegation of agency power. And that's essentially what the Major Questions Doctrine is. In certain extraordinary cases, we must be skeptical that whether Congress intended to grant that degree of power to the EPA. And they decided that here they would apply the Major Questions Doctrine. Congress had not explicitly said that the EPA could regulate agency-wide, and therefore they would essentially vacate the Clean Power Plan and state this new doctrine that would be in effect going forward.
So I guess the thing is that the Major Questions Doctrine, as you say, doctrine is something that you read in a, you know, well-established, these guys sort of made up this idea. And, you know, made up an idea that was useful to get to the end that they wanted. It seems to me it's sort of motivated reasoning, right? They wanted to kill the Obama plan, and so they had to find some justification for it. And this presented itself just like the guy from the 1760s who burned witches, right? Just pull that out of the history and, you know, we'll use it because it's convenient. Is that true, do you think?
That's essentially it. It's what the language that you're searching for is, it's a results-oriented opinion. They knew where they wanted to get, and so they cherry-picked the law and the precedent and the, quote, doctrine that they wanted to use to get to the end that they wanted to get to. I mean, there's nine of them. Six of them think the same way. There's nobody that can contradict them. There's no way to pull them back. So they can pronounce this new thing and just run roughshod with it, which is kind of what it feels like. Now, keep in mind, Major Questions Doctrine had never been stated before in any case. In any case, Kagan points that out in her dissent. She says, and her dissent is brilliant, she says that the Major Questions Doctrine magically appeared. Magically appeared. It's a get out of jail card. They never used the term before. Now, the, you know, Gorsuch and Roberts come back and say, oh, yes, you know, we relied on certain cases. And what they're looking at is about six or seven cases, some of them fairly recent, that have to do with agencies expanding their authority and the court shut them down. For example, the recent one where the CDC tried to legislate that they could not evict during COVID times.
Right.
And I believe OSHA was requiring mask wearing in right. industry. They said that was outside OSHA. There's a couple of historical cases that make some sense when you hear it, but they're only common sense. They aren't here. One of them had to do with whether the FDA could regulate tobacco. And the question was, the FDA is permitted to regulate products that can be rendered safe to be put on the market, and tobacco couldn't be rendered safe.
Really?
And so they said it can't be that it's within that, it's got to be, it's implicitly power taken on by the FDA. And the other one I think you'll be interested in was Attorney General under Bush, Gonzalez, who tried to say that he, the Attorney General, ought to be allowed to pull the licenses of physicians, licensed physicians, who were willing to assist suicide cases. Mm-hmm. And so the court said, the Attorney General is not in a position to make a decision about pulling the licenses of medical doctors. Right. And so that's the kind of history that it comes out of. And so what they really mean is, Kagan points out, is that the Congress did not intend to grant all authority to everybody. They wanted the agencies to stay in their own lane. And the FDA wasn't staying in its own lane when it got into tobacco. And Gonzalez wasn't in his own lane when he was getting into doctor's licenses. But she points out the EPA is completely within its own lane here.
Right, right.
This is the EPA's area of expertise. It's nonsense. But they come up with the major questions doctrine, which has, again, now this Professor Vermeule, who's the head of he's a constitutional law department at Harvard Law School. He writes in the Washington Post, it's a doctrine ungoverned by ordinary legal principles. ungoverned by ordinary legal principles. You know, really, Ted, you're going to put that on the blog because it is just a brilliant takedown of this decision that there is no modern, there is no conservative legal jurisprudence. There is none. He points out that there's supposedly four pillars of conservative thought. There's originalism, textualism, judicial modesty, judicial restraint, and something else that will come to me in a second. Traditionalism.
Power of energy.
Traditionalism. And there's none of them are reflected in this EPA decision. And what he says is it's not a body of law. It is a libertarian framework developed in the Federalist Society. And it's funded by a whole lot of money and a whole lot of advocates, and particularly the architect of it is Don McGahn. Remember that name?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I never heard of him before.
And he's the one who got Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the bench. I don't think he could take credit for Barrett, yeah. But I think he got those two on there. And he is supposed to have announced at the Federalist Society after the death of Scalia. That Scalia would never really cut it with regard to regulatory law. He was too solid with that from now on they were going to focus on taking down the administrative state in terms of the Federalist Society and the conservatives. So that is all part of this long-term plan. Well, I mean, where are we going now?
That leads us there are two threads in our final few minutes. The two threads that and let me just I will kind of state one and then I will set one up for you and you can tell me about it. One is that based on this ruling from the Supreme Court that the Obama plan is unconstitutional, that their interpretation of the best system of emission reductions is unconstitutional, that still leaves the EPA with a fair amount of authority to regulate carbon. It's more difficult, probably more expensive, but the EPA still has the authority to do things. And presumably we'll be crafting a new regulation that the Supreme Court can accept. And I guess that leads into the second and perhaps more important discussion is that this major questions doctrine is a license to kill on the Supreme Court, right? If you don't like what the Federal Aviation Administration just did, it's a major question, right? And there's no clear, unambiguous definition of what's a major question. And so in a sense, this whole thing is a power grab by the Supreme Court. They say that, you know, they have hidden the criteria they're going to use, but if they don't like what the agency does, they will knock it down. And that puts all federal agencies now sort of looking left and looking right, looking sideways to try and figure out, will my regulation survive the major question doctrine? And that is the Steve Bannon disassembling of the administrative state. I mean, what do you think the implications of this use of the major questions doctrine by the Supreme Court is?
I think it's a pretty fair characterization, Ted, that you've just offered us. I think that with almost every piece of litigation that has to go, you know, where there is some complaint with regard to rulemaking with regard to regulations that have been passed that Congress did not explicitly grant that power to the agency, and therefore it must be nullified. And so I think that it is going to provoke an enormous amount of regulation, litigation and administrative law litigation going forward, and will seriously hamper the administrative agencies from getting the business done.
All right. Well, let's put it down there, because it is, that's a heavy thought, and we need to be watching the Supreme Court. There's a whole raft of things you can think about doing, but for the moment, let's just say that the Supreme Court is has taken on a role and an importance that maybe Benjamin Franklin and George Washington hadn't quite imagined. But we're, you know, that's a discussion for other days, right, Fran?
Yeah, I just would often say, I think the EPA is still in business. The EPA can still regulate greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide. The only thing that really has been taken off the table is this sector-wide generation shifting cap and trade requirement. They can still regulate within the fence of the individual agencies, and they can still regulate greenhouse gases. But with regard to what they had been doing before that was industry-wide, that was going to put the coal business out of business, they can't do that no more.
I don't know if it's legitimate. It's a whole a new sort of topic of discussion. But there's this technology called carbon capture and sequestration, where with a coal plant you capture all the CO2 coming out of the smokestack and then bury it somewhere. Right? Never been shown to work, but the proponents always point to it as this great thing. So it seems like, I mean, ironically, the EPA could say, all right, you don't want system-wide, you don't like my generation shifting, you must install carbon capture and sequestration on your stupid coal plant in South Dakota, and then the coal plant's going to go belly up because it can't afford to do it, right? So, I mean, I don't know. It's like, call the Supreme Court's bluff, but that's just me.
Watch what you pray for, in other words, you know.
Yes, be careful what you ask for, because you might get it. Anyway, Fran, thank you very much. What we'll do is at some point we'll put up links, and I'll get this thing from the post that you sent me and include that.
The bottom line on this is, you know, Congress needs to step up, which means we need to win Congress. So everybody's got to vote.
Right.
This is what this comes down to. I mean, it could all be solved very quickly if Congress could get its act together and say, regulate industry-wide carbon emissions.
And that's exactly what the Koch brothers know isn't going to happen. Right? The dark money knows Congress is scleric and isn't going to act. So this is the best way to. Oh, all right. Okay, see, I was happy for a minute, Fran, but then you spanked everyone till we cried. It's like, what we'll do is. We'll put up links on the blog that you can go and read some of these articles. The blog is at massclimateaction.org. Look for newsletter and more. Pull that down to blog and podcast, and you finally find links. If you have any comments or ideas for future shows, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should talk about. You are probably listening to this show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all your friends to listen to us on their smartphones using Apple, Google, all of them. We're there. Just search for Mass Climate Action Climate Minute. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. And we'll close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States, despite the Supreme Court, transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Fran, thanks for your wisdom and insight. Really appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Ted. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.